Chapter 13. You are now at liberty to leave this courtroom, not guiltless of the crime of murder, perhaps, but at least rid of its punishment. The eyes of men may see Cain's mark on your brow, but the eyes of the law are blind to it. When the audience fully realized what the judge had said, they were amazed and silent. They knew as well as men could know that Victor Ancona was guilty of murder, and yet he was now going out of the courtroom free. Could it happen that the law protected only against the blundering rogue? They had heard always of the boasted completeness of the law which magistrates from time immemorial had labored to perfect, and now when the skillful villain sought to evade it, they saw how weak a thing it was. The wedding march of Lohengrin floated out from the Episcopal Church of St. Mark, clear and sweet, and perhaps heavy with its paradox of warning. The theater of this coming contract before high heaven was a wilderness of roses worth the taxes of a county. The high caste of Manhattan, by the grace of the checkbook, were present, clothed in Parisian purple and fine linen, cunningly and marvelously wrought. Over in her private pew, ablaze with jewels, and decked with fabrics from the deft hand of many a weaver, sat Mrs. Miriam Stuyvesant, as imperious and self-complacent as a queen. To her it was all a kind of triumphal procession, proclaiming her ability as a general. With her were a choice few of the genus homo, which obtains at the 5 o'clock teas, instituted, say the sages, for the purpose of sprinkling the holy water of Lethe. Serena, whispered Reggie Dupeister, leaning forward, I salute you. The ceremony sub jugum is superb. Walcott is an excellent fellow, answered Mrs. Stuyvesant. Not a vice, you know, Reggie. I, Empress, put in the others, a purist taken in the net. The clean-skirted one has come to the altar. Vive la Virtu! Samuel Walcott, still sunburned from his cruise, stood before the chancel with the only daughter of the blue-blooded St. Clair's. His face was clear and honest, and his voice firm. This was life and not romance. The lid of the sepulcher had closed and he had slipped from under it. And now, and ever after, the hand red with murder was clean as any. The minister raised his voice, proclaiming the holy union before God, and this twain, half pure, half foul, now by divine ordinance one flesh, bowed down before it. No blood cried from the ground. The sunlight of high noon streamed down through the window panes like a benediction. Back in the pew of Mrs. Miriam Stuyvesant, Reggie Dupeister turned down his thumb. A bet, he said. From The Strange Schemes of Randolph Mason, by Melville Davison Post. Copyright, 1896 by G. P. Putnam's Sons. Ambrose Bierce, an heiress from Redorce, Coronado, June 20th. I find myself more and more interested in him. It is not, I am sure, his do you know any noun corresponding to the adjective handsome? One does not like to say Odie when speaking of a man. He is handsome enough, heaven knows. I should not even care to trust you with him, faithful of all possible wives, that you are when he looks his best, as he always does. Nor do I think the fascination of his manner has much to do with it. You recollect that the charm of Ardenier's in that which is undefinable, and to you and me, my dear Irene, I fancy there is rather less of that in the branch of art under consideration than to girls in their first season. I fancy I know how my fine gentleman produces many of his effects, and could, perhaps, give him a pointer on heightening them. Nevertheless, his manner is something truly delightful. I suppose what interests me chiefly is the man's brains. His conversation is the best I have ever heard, and altogether unlike anyone's else. He seems to know everything, as, indeed, he ought, for he has been everywhere, read everything, seen all there is to see, sometimes I think rather more than is good for him, and had acquaintance with the queerest people. And then his voice, Irene, when I hear it, I actually feel as if I ought to have paid at the door, though, of course, it is my own door. July 3D, I fear my remarks about Dr. Barrett's must have been, being thoughtless, Very silly, or you would not have written of him with such levity, not to say disrespect. Believe me, dearest, he has more dignity and seriousness of the kind, I mean, which is not inconsistent with a manner sometimes playful and always charming than any of the men that you and I ever met. And young Rayner, you knew Rayner at Monterey, tells me that the men all like him, and that he is treated with something like deference everywhere. There is a mystery, too, something about his connection with the Blavatsky people in northern India. Rayner either would not, or could not tell me the particulars. I infer that Dr. Barrett's thought, don't you dare to laugh at me, a magician. Could anything be finer than that? An ordinary mystery is not, of course, as good as a scandal, but when it relates to dark and dreadful practices, to the exercise of unearthly powers, could anything be more piquant? It explains, too, the singular influence the man has upon me. It is the undefinable in his art, black art. Seriously, dear, I quite tremble when he looks me full in the eyes with those unfathomable orbs of his, which I have already vainly attempted to describe to you. How dreadful if we have the power to make one fall in love! Do you know, if the Blavatsky crowd have that power outside of Sepoy? July 1, the strangest thing. Last evening while Auntie was attending one of the hotel hops, I hate them, Dr. Barrett's called. It was scandalously late. I actually believe he had talked with Auntie in the ballroom, and learned from her that I was alone. I had been all the evening contriving how to worm out of him the truth about his connection with the thugs in Sepoy, and all of that black business. But the moment he fixed his eyes on me, for I admitted him, I'm ashamed to say, I was helpless. I trembled, I blushed, Irene, I love the man beyond expression, and you know how it is yourself. Fancy. I, an ugly duckling from Redor's daughter, they say, of old Calamity Jim, certainly his heiress, with no living relation, but an absurd old aunt, who spoils me 1,050 ways, absolutely destitute of everything but $1,000,000, and a open parasite daring to love a god like him. My dear, if I had you here, I could tear your hair out with mortification. I am convinced that he is aware of my feeling, for he stayed but a few moments, said nothing but what another man might have said half as well, and pretending that he had an engagement, went away. I learned today, a little bird told me, the bell bird, that he went straight to bed. How does that strike you as evidence of exemplary habits? July 17th. That little wretch, Rayner, called yesterday, and his babble set me almost wild. He never runs down, that is to say, when he exterminates a score of reputations, more or less, he does not pause between one reputation and the next. By the way, he inquired about you, and his manifestations of interest in you had, I confess, a good deal of resemblance. Mr. Rayner observes no game laws. Like death, which he would inflict, if slander were fatal, he has all seasons for his own. But I like him, for we knew one another at Redor's when we were young, and true-hearted and barefooted. He was known in those far fair days as Eagles, and Irene, can you ever forgive me? I was called a knight. God knows why, perhaps in allusion to the material of my pinafores, perhaps because the name is in alliteration with Giggles, for Gig and I were inseparable playmates, and the miners may have thought it a delicate compliment to recognize some kind of relationship between us. Later, we took in a third another of adversity's brood, who, like Garrick between tragedy and comedy, had a chronic inability to adjudicate the rival claims to himself of frost and famine. Between him and the grave there was seldom anything more than a single suspender, and the hope of a meal which would at the same time support life and make it insupportable. He literally picked up a precarious living for himself and an aged mother by chloriding the dumps, that is to say, the miners permitted him to search the heaps of waste rock for such pieces of ore as had been overlooked, and these he sacked up and sold at the syndicate mill. He became a member of our firm, and I, Giggles, and Dumps, thenceforth through my favor, Therefore I could not then, nor can I now, be indifferent to his courage and prowess in defending against Giggles the immemorial right of his sex to insult a strange and unprotected female myself. After old Jim struck it in the calamity, and I began to wear shoes, and go to school, and in emulation Giggles took to washing his face, and became Jack Rayner, of Wells, Fargo, and Company, and old Mrs. Bartz was herself chlorided to her father's, dumps drifted over to San Juan Smith and turned stage driver, and was killed by road agents, and so forth. Why do I tell you all this, dear? Because it is heavy on my heart. Because I walk the valley of humility. Because I am subduing myself to permanent consciousness of my unworthiness, to unloose the latchet of Dr. Barrett's shoe. Because oh, dear, there's a cousin of Dump's at this hotel. I haven't spoken to him. I never had any acquaintance with him, but do you suppose he has recognized me? Do please, give me in your next ear candid, sure enough opinion about it, and say you don't think so. Do you think he knows about me already, and that is why he left me last evening when he saw that I blushed and trembled like a fool under his eyes? You know I can't bribe all the newspapers, and I can't go back on anybody who was good to Gunny at three doors, not if I'm pitched out of society into the sea. So the skeleton sometimes rattles behind the door. I never cared much before, as you know, but now it is not the same. Jack Rayner I am sure of he will not tell him. He seems, indeed, to hold him in such respect as hardly to dare speak to him at all, and I'm a good deal that way myself. Dear, I wish I had something besides $1,000,000. If Jack were 3 inches taller I'd marry him alive, and go back to Redorse and wear sackcloth again to the end of my miserable days. July 25th. We had a perfectly splendid sunset last evening, and I must tell you all about it. I ran away from Auntie and everybody, and was walking alone on the beach. I expect you to believe, you infidel, that I had not looked out of my window on the seaward side of the hotel, and seen him walking alone on the beach. If you are not lost to every feeling of womanly delicacy you will accept my statement without question. I soon established myself under my sunshade, and had for some time been gazing out dreamily over the sea, when he approached, walking close to the edge of the water it was ebb tide. I assure you the wet sand actually brightened about his feet. As he approached me, he lifted his hat, saying Miss Dement, may I sit with you, or will you walk with me? The possibility that neither might be agreeable seems not to have occurred to him. Did you ever know such assurance? Assurance? My dear, it was gall, downright gall. Well, I didn't find it wormwood, and replied, with my untutored redorse heart in my throat, I shall be pleased to do anything. Could words have been more stupid? There are depths of fatuity in me, friend o' my soul, which are simply bottomless. He extended his hand, smiling, and I delivered mine into it without a moment's hesitation, and when his fingers closed about it to assist me to my feet, the consciousness that it trembled made me blush worse than the Red West. I got up, however, and after a while, observing that he had not let go my hand, I pulled on it a little, but unsuccessfully. He simply held on, saying nothing, but looking down into my face with some kind of a smile I didn't know how could I, whether it was affectionate, derisive, or what, for I did not look at him. How beautiful he was, with the red fires of the sunset burning in the depths of his eyes. Do you know, dear, if the thugs and experts of the Blavatsky region have any special kind of eyes? Ah, you should have seen his superb attitude, the godlike inclination of his head as he stood over me, after I had got upon my feet. It was a noble picture, but I soon destroyed it, for I began at once to sink again to the earth. There was only one thing for him to do, and he did it. He supported me with an arm about my waist. Miss Dement, are you ill? He said. It was not an exclamation. There was neither alarm nor solicitude in it. If he had added colon, I suppose that is about what I am expected to say, he would hardly have expressed his sense of the situation more clearly. His manner filled me with shame and indignation, for I was suffering acutely. I wrenched my hand out of his, grasped the arm supporting me, and, pushing myself free, fell plump into the sand and sat helpless. My hat had fallen off in the struggle, and my hair tumbled about my face and shoulders in the most mortifying way. "Go away from me," I cried, half choking. "H, please go away, you thug. How dare you think that, when my leg is asleep?" I actually said those identical words. And then I broke down and sobbed. "Irene," I blubbered. His manner altered in an instant. I could see that much through my fingers and hair. He dropped on one knee beside me, parted the tangle of hair, and said, in the tenderest way, "My poor girl, God knows I have not intended to pain you. How should I? I who love you, I who have loved you for 4 years and years." He had pulled my wet hands away from my face, and was covering them with kisses. My cheeks were like two coals, my whole face was flaming, and, I think, steaming. What could I do? I hit it on his shoulder. There was no other place. And, oh, my dear friend, how my leg tingled and thrilled, and how I wanted to kick. We sat so for a long time. He had released one of my hands, to pass his arm about me again, and I possessed myself of my handkerchief, and was drying my eyes and my nose. I would not look up until that was done. He tried in vain to push me a little away, and gaze into my eyes. Presently, when it was all right, and it had grown a bit dark, I lifted my head, looked him straight in the eyes, and smiled my best, my level best, dear. "What do you mean," I said, "by years and years?" "Dearest," he replied, very gravely, very earnestly, in the absence of the sunken cheeks, the hollow eyes, the lank hair, the slouching gait, the rags, dirt, and youth, "can you not, will you not understand? Gunny, I'm dumps." In a moment I was upon my feet and he upon his. I seized him by the lapels of his coat and peered into his handsome face in the deepening darkness. I was breathless with excitement. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.